families or friends, or from charitably inclined souls in the community, if they were imprisoned far from home. Likely wives wouldn't be allowed in a military prison, though. Have you got any paper in your study? I asked, sliding off the log.
Aye.
Why? He folded the letter, raising a brow at me. I'm going to write to John Gray, I said, trying to sound as though this were both a simple and an obvious thing to do. Well, it was obvious, or so I thought.
No, you're not.
He said it calmly, though his answer had come so fast I thought he'd said it from pure reflex. Then I looked at his eyes. I straightened my back, folded my arms, and fixed him with a stare of my own. Would you care to rephrase that? I said politely. One of the benefits of long marriage is that you can see quite clearly where some conversations are likely to lead, and occasionally you can sidestep the booby traps and choose another path by silent mutual assent. He pursed his lips a little, looking thoughtfully up at me. Then he took a deep breath and nodded.
Dorothea will write to her father, if she hasn't done it already, he said reasonably.
He tucked Judah's letter into his sporran and stood up.
His Grace will do whatever can be done.
We don't know that Dotty can write to her father. She may not be near Denzel. She may not even know that he's in prison. For that matter, we don't know where Hal, the Duke is either, I added. Bloody hell, I shouldn't have called Hal by his first name. But he and John can both be found, at least. The British Army certainly knows where they are.
By the time I sent a message to Savannah or New York, Denzel will likely have been released, or paroled, or moved,
or died. I unfolded my arms. For heaven's sake, Jamie, if anybody knows what the conditions are like inside a British prison, it's you. He turned to go, but at this his head whipped round like a snake's.
Aye, I do.
Aye, he did. Prison is where he'd met John. Besides, I said, trying to scramble back onto safer ground, I said I'd write to him. Denzel's more my friend than yours. You needn't be involved at all. The blood was rising up the column of his neck, never a good sign. I didn't mean to be involved, he said, handling the word as though it had fleas. And I didn't mean you to be involved with John Gray. After all, he added as an emphatic footnote, and snatched up the shovel with which he'd been digging the new well for the garden, in a manner suggesting that he would have liked nothing better than to crown John Gray with it, or, failing that, me. I'm not suggesting any sort of involvement, I said, with a fair assumption of calm.
It's a wee bit late for that, he said,
with a nasty emphasis that sent the blood up into my own cheeks. For God's sake! You know what happened, and how. You know
I ken what happened. He laid you down on his bed, spread your thighs, and swived you. You think I'm ever going to hear the man's name and not think of that?
He said something very rude in Gaelic, featuring John's testicles, drove the blade of his shovel into the ground, then pulled it up again. I breathed slowly through my nose, lips pressed firmly together. I thought, I said, after a moment, that we'd done with that. I had rather thought that. Apparently that had been wishful thinking on my part. And quite suddenly, I remembered what he'd said. Well, one of the things he'd said, when he'd come to find me in Bartram's garden. He risen from the dead and smelling of cabbages, me, mud-stained, and shattered with joy.
I have loved you since I saw you, Sassenach. I will love you forever. It does not matter if you sleep with a whole English army. Well, no, he had corrected himself. It would matter, but it wouldn't have stopped me loving you.
I drew a slightly calmer breath, though my mind went right ahead and presented me with something else he'd said later in that conversation.
I don't say that I dinna mind this, because I do. And I don't say that I'll no make a fuss about it later, because I likely will.
He moved close to me and looked down into my face, blue eyes dark with intent.
Did I tell you once that I am a jealous man?
You did, but...
And did I tell you that I grudged every hour you'd spent in another man's bed?
I took a deep breath to squash down the hasty words I could feel boiling up.
You did?
I said, through only slightly clenched teeth. He glared at me for a long moment.
I meant it, he said. I still mean it. You'll do what you damn please. God knows you always do. But don't pretend you dinna ken what I feel about it.
He turned on his heel and stalked off, shovel over his shoulder like a rifle. My fists were clenched so hard I could feel my nails cutting into my palms. I would have thrown a rock at him, but he was already out of range, and moving fast, shoulders bunched with anger. "What about William?" I bellowed after him. "If he's involved with John, so are you, you pig-headed Scot!" The shoulders bunched harder, but he didn't turn round. His shout floated back to me, though.
"Damn, William!"
A small cough from behind me distracted me from the mental list of synonyms for bloody Scot I was compiling. I turned round to find Fanny standing there, her apron bulging with dirt-covered turnips and her sweet face fixed in a troubled frown, this directed at Jamie, who was vanishing into the trees by the creek.
"What has William done, Mrs. Fraser?" she asked, glancing up at me from under her cap.
I smiled, in spite of the recent upheaval. Her speech was very fluent now, save when she was upset or talking fast, but she often still had that slight hesitation between the syllables of William's name. "William hasn't done anything amiss," I assured her. "Not that I know of. We haven't seen him since, I broke off, an instant too late.
"Jane's funeral," she said soberly,
and looked down into the purple and white mass of turnips.
"I thought maybe Mr. Fraser had had a letter from William, or maybe about him," she added, the frown returning.
She nodded toward the trees.
"He's angry."
"He's Scottish," I amended with a sigh, "which means stubborn, also unreasonable, intolerant, contumelious, froward, pig-headed, and a few other objectionable things. But don't worry, it really isn't anything to do with William. Here, let's put the turnips in the tub there and cover them with water. That will keep the tops from wilting. I'm making bashed neeps for supper, but I want to cook the tops with bacon grease and serve them alongside. If anything will make Highlanders eat a leafy green vegetable, bacon grease ought to do it." She nodded as though this made sense, and let down her apron slowly, so the turnips rolled out into the tub in a tumbling cascade, dark green tops waving like pom-poms.
"You probably shouldn't have told him," Fanny spoke with an almost clinical detachment.
"Told who what?" I said, picking up a water bucket and sloshing it over the muddy turnips. "Get another bucket, will you?" She did, heaved the water into the tub, then set down the bucket, looked up at me, and said seriously,
"I know what swived means."
I felt as though she'd just kicked me sharply in the shin.
"Do you indeed?" I managed, picking up my working knife. Suppose you would."
She'd spent half her short life in a brothel in Philadelphia. She probably knew a lot of other words not in the vocabulary of the average 12-year-old.
"It's too bad," she said, turning to fetch another bucket.
The boys had filled all of them this morning. There were 6 left.
"I like his lordship a lot. He was so good to me. And Jane. I like Mr. Fraser, too," she added, though with a certain reserve.
"I'm sure he appreciates your good opinion," I said gravely, wondering, "What the hell?" "And yes, his lordship is a very fine man. He's always been a good friend to us."
I put a bit of emphasis on the "us" and saw that register.
"Oh."
A small frown disturbed the perfect skin of her forehead.
"I suppose suppose that makes it worse, that you went to bed with him, she explained, lest I have missed her point. Men don't like to share a woman, unless it's an Ameses.
An Ameses? I was beginning to wonder how I might extricate myself from this conversation with any sort of dignity. I was also beginning to feel rather alarmed.
That's what Mrs. Abbott called it, when two men wanted to do things to a girl at the same time. It costs more than it would to have two girls, because they often damage her. Mostly just bruises, she added fairly, but still.
Ah. I paused for a moment, then picked up the last bucket and finished filling the tub. The smaller turnips bobbed on the surface of the water, hairy roots shedding swirls of dirt. I looked down at Fanny, who met my eyes with an expression of calm interest. I'd really rather she didn't share her interesting thoughts with anyone else on the ridge, and I was reasonably sure that Jamie would feel the same.
Come, sit down with me inside for a moment, will you, Fanny?
Not waiting for acquiescence, I beckoned her to follow me back to the house. I pushed aside the canvas sheet that was substituting for the front door of our emergent house and led the way into the cavernous space of the kitchen. The canvas covering the door stirred gently with the sound of sails, and the space had a soothing dimness, broken only by light from the open back door and the two windows that looked out onto the well and the garden path. We had a table and benches, but in addition there were two serviceable three-legged stools, one rather decrepit wooden chair that Maggie McCallan had given me in payment for midwifing the birth of her granddaughter, two small kegs of salt fish, and several packing cases that hadn't yet been broken down for their lumber, whose presence increased the ambient illusion of being in the hold of a ship under sail. I motioned Fanny to one stool and took the other, sighing with the pleasure of taking the weight off my feet. Fanny sat too, looking mildly apprehensive, and I smiled, in hopes of reassuring her. "You really needn't worry about William," I said. "He's a very resourceful young man. He's just a bit confused, I think, and maybe angry. But I'm sure he'll get over that soon."
"Oh," Fanny said slowly, "you mean nobody told him that Mr. Fraser is his father, but then he found out?"
She frowned at her clasped hands, then looked up at me.
"I think I'd be angry too. But why is Mr. Fraser angry? Did he give William away?"
Not exactly. I looked at Fanny with some concern. Within a very few minutes, without knowing it, she'd managed to touch on a good many of the family secrets, including the very hot potato of my relations with Lord John. "Mr. Fraser was a Jacobite. Do you know what that means?"
She nodded uncertainly.
"The Jacobites were supporters of James Stuart and fought against the King of England," I explained. "They lost that war." A hollow place opened under my ribs as I spoke. So few words for such a shattering of so very many lives. "Mr. Fraser went to prison afterward. He wasn't able to take care of William. Lord John was his friend, and he raised William as his son because neither of them thought that Mr. Fraser would ever be released, and Lord John thought that he would never have children of his own." I caught the distant echo of Frank's advice, like a spider's whisper behind the empty hearth. "Always stick to the truth as far as possible."
"Was Lord John wounded?" Fanny asked. "In the war?"
"Wounded? Oh, because he couldn't have children, you mean?" "I don't know. He was certainly wounded, though." I'd seen his scars. I cleared my throat. "Let me tell you something, Fanny, about myself." Her eyes widened in curiosity. They were a soft, light brown, gone almost black as her pupils went large in the shadows of the kitchen. "I fought in a war too," I said. "Not the same war. Another one, in a different country, before I met either Mr. Fraser or Lord John. I was a healer. I took care of wounded men, and I spent a lot of time among soldiers and in bad places." I took a breath, fragments of those times and places coming back. I knew the memories must show on my face, and I let them. I've seen very bad things, I said simply. I know you have too. Her chin trembled slightly, and she looked away, her soft mouth drawing in on itself. I reached out slowly and touched her shoulder. You can say anything to me, I said, with slight emphasis on anything. You don't ever have to tell me or Mr. Fraser anything that you don't want to. But if there are things that you want to talk about, your sister maybe, or anything else, you can. Anyone in the family, me, Mr. Fraser, Brianna, or Mr. Mackenzie, you can tell any of us anything you need to. We won't be shocked. Actually, we probably would be, I thought, but no matter. And perhaps we can help, if you're troubled about anything. But... She looked up at that, instantly alert, unsettling me a little. This child had had a lot of experience in detecting and interpreting tones of voice, probably as a matter of survival. But, I repeated firmly, not everyone who lives on the ridge has had such experiences, and many of them have never met anyone who has. Most of them have lived in small villages in Scotland. Many of them aren't educated. They would be shocked, perhaps, if you told them very much about where you lived, how you and your sister... They've never met Hawes, she said, and blinked. I think some of the men must have. Doubtless you're right, I said, trying to keep my grip on the conversation. But it's the women who talk. She nodded soberly. I could see a thought come to her. She looked away for an instant, blinked, then looked back at me, a thoughtful squint to her eyes. What? I said.
Mrs. MacDonald's mother says you're a witch, she replied. Mrs. MacDonald tried to make her stop when she saw I was listening, but the old lady doesn't stop talking about anything, ever, except when she's eating.
I'd met Janet MacDonald's mother, Granny Campbell, once or twice, and wasn't overly surprised to hear this. I don't suppose she's the only one, I said, a little tersely. But I'm suggesting that perhaps you should be careful about what you say to people outside the family about your life in Philadelphia. She nodded, accepting what I'd said.
It doesn't matter that Granny Campbell says you're a witch, she said thoughtfully, because Mr. MacDonald is afraid of Mr. Fraser. He tried to make Granny stop talking about you, she added, and shrugged. Anyway, nobody's afraid of me.
Give them time, child, I thought, eyeing her. I wouldn't say that people are afraid of Mr. Fraser, really, but they do respect him, I said carefully. She ducked her head a little, indicating that she knew better but wasn't going to argue with me.
Sometimes, she said, one of the girls would find a protector. Once, in a very long while, he would even marry her.
She sighed briefly at the thought.
But usually he just would make sure that she had good food and nice clothes and nobody would hurt her or use her badly.
I didn't know quite where this was going, but tilted my head inquiringly.
When my sister met William again near Philadelphia, he said that he would take her and me both under his protection. She was so happy.
Her small, clear voice was suddenly thick with tears.
If we could have stayed with him.
Jamie had told me exactly what had happened to Fanny's sister Jane, and had done so in the bare minimum of words, his terseness betraying just how deeply it had shocked him, and how deeply it had wounded both him and William. I got up and knelt down by Fanny, gathering her into my arms. She wept almost silently, in the way of a child hiding grief or pain for fear of attracting punishment, and I held her tight, my own eyes stinging with tears.
"Fanny," I whispered at last, "you're safe. We won't let anything happen to you ever again."
She hiccuped and shuddered briefly, but didn't cling to me. She didn't move away either, just sat on her stool, quiet and fragile as a wounded bird, her feathers fluffed to keep what life she still had.
"William," she said,
so low I could hardly hear her.
"He asked Mr. Fraser to look after me, but Mr. Fraser doesn't have to. I'm not really under his protection."
"You are, Fanny," I said into the limp linen smell of her cap, and patted her gently. "William gave you to him, and
now he's angry with William."
She pulled away, knuckling the tears from her eyes. "Oh, dear God. You mean you're afraid that we'd put you out because Mr. Fraser has a difference of opinion with William? No. No, really, Fanny. Believe me, that won't happen." She gave me a doubtful look, but nodded dutifully. Clearly she didn't believe me. "Mr. Fraser is a man of his word." She looked at me for a long moment, a frown puckering the soft skin between her brows. Then she stood up abruptly, wiped her sleeve under her nose, and curtsied to me.
"I won't talk to anybody," she said, "about anything."
Chapter 36. What Lies Unseen. I had made up my mind what to do about Denny within moments of shouting "pig-headed Scott" at Jamie, but the ensuing conversation with Fanny had momentarily driven the matter out of my mind, and what with one thing and another, it was late the next afternoon before I managed to find Brianna alone. Sean McHugh and his two biggest lads had come in the morning with their hammers to help with the roofing of the kitchen and the framing of the third story. Jamie and Roger had been up there with them, and the effect of five large men armed with hammers was much like that of a platoon of overweight woodpeckers marching in close formation overhead. They'd been at it all morning, causing everyone else to flee the house, but had broken for a late lunch down by the creek, and I'd seen Bree go back inside with Mandy. I found her in my rudimentary surgery, sitting in the late sun that fell through the big window, the largest window in the new house. There was no glass in it yet. There might not be glass before spring, if then, but the flood of unobstructed afternoon light was glorious, glowing from the new yellow pine boards of the floor, the soft butternut of Bree's homespun skirt, and the fiery nimbus of her hair, half bound in a long, loose plait. She was drawing, and watching her absorbed in the paper pinned to her lap desk, I felt a deep envy of her gift. Not for the first time. I would have given a lot to be able to capture what I saw now. Brianna, bronze and fire and the deep clear light, head bent as she watched Mandy on the floor, chanting to herself, as she built an edifice of wooden blocks and the small heavy glass bottles I used for tinctures and dried herbs.
"What are you thinking, Mama?"
"What did you say?" I looked up at Bree, blinking, and her mouth curled up.
"I said," she repeated patiently, "what are you thinking? You have that look."
"Which look is that?" I asked wearily. It was an article of faith amongst the members of my family that I couldn't keep secrets, that everything I thought was visible on my face. They weren't entirely right, but they weren't completely wrong either. What never occurred to them was just how transparent they were to me. Brianna tilted her head to one side, eyes narrowed as she examined my face. I smiled pleasantly, putting out a hand to intercept Mandy as she trotted past me, three medicine bottles in hand.
"You can't take Granny's bottles outside, sweetheart," I said, removing them deftly from her chubby grasp. "Granny needs them to put medicine in."
"But I'm going to catch leeches with Jemmy and Aidan and Germain."
"You couldn't get even one leech into a bottle that size," I said, standing up
and placing the bottles on a shelf out of reach. I scanned the next shelf down and found a slightly chipped pottery bowl with a lid. Here, take this. I wrapped a small linen towel around the bowl and tucked it into the pocket of her pinafore. Be sure to put in a little mud, all right? No more than a pinch. And some of the water weeds you find the leeches in. That will keep them happy. I watched her trot out of the door, black curls bouncing, then braced myself and turned back to Bree. Well, if you must know, I was thinking how much I should tell you. She laughed, though with sympathy. That's the look, all right. You always look like a heron staring into the water when you have something you can't quite decide whether to tell somebody. A heron? Beady-eyed and intent, she explained. A contemplative killer. I'll draw you doing it one of these days so you can see. Contemplative? I'll take your word for it. I don't think you've ever met Denzel Hunter, have you? She shook her head. No. Ian mentioned him once or twice, I think. A Quaker doctor? Isn't he Rachel's brother? That's him. To keep it to the essentials for the moment, he's a wonderful doctor, a good friend of mine, and besides being Rachel's brother, he's married to the daughter of the Duke of Pardlow, who happens to be Lord John Grey's elder brother. Lord John! Her face, already glowing with light, broke into a brilliant smile. My favourite person outside the family. Have you heard from him? How is he? Fine, to the best of my knowledge. I saw him briefly in Savannah a few months ago. The British Army is still there, so it's likely he is too. I'd thought out what to say in hopes of avoiding anything awkward, but a script is not a conversation. I was thinking that you might write to him. I suppose I might, she said, tilting her head and looking at me sideways, one red brow raised. Right this minute? Well, soonish. The thing is, Jamie's just had a letter from one of his aides from the army. I'll tell you about that later. Anyway, the gist of it is that Denzel Hunter was captured by the British Army and is being held in a military prison camp at Stony Point. Captured doing what? She sat up straighter and set her lap desk aside. She hadn't been drawing a sentimental portrait of her daughter, I saw. It looked like a floor plan of something, embellished with small marginal sketches of apes. You said he's a Quaker? I sighed. Yes, he's what they call a fighting Quaker, but he doesn't fight. He joined the Continental Army as a surgeon, though, and was evidently scooped up off a battlefield somewhere. Sounds like an interesting man, she remarked, the brow still high. What does he have to do with me writing to Lord John? I explained, as briefly as possible, the connections and possibilities, concluding, so we want to see that the Duke knows where Denny is. Even if he can't get him released directly, and knowing Hal, I wouldn't bet against him doing exactly that, he can make sure that Denny's well-treated, and naturally he'll find Dottie and see she's taken care of. Bree was watching me with a curiously analytic look on her face, as though she were estimating the sheer forces on the girders of a bridge. What? I said. John was a good friend of yours. Before, I mean. I should think you'd want to write to him in any case. Oh, I do, she assured me. I'm just wondering why you aren't writing to him. Or for that matter, why aren't you writing to Hal, since you're on first-name terms, I mean. Damn, I couldn't outright lie. Questions of honesty aside, she detected instantly. Stick to the truth as much as possible, then. Well, it's Jamie, I said, reluctantly. It was, but I felt some scruples about dropping him in it with Bree. He had a falling out with the Greys a little while ago. They're not on speaking terms, and if I were to write to John or Hal, he'd... Take it amiss, I ended rather weakly. Being her father's daughter, she instantly put her finger on the crux of the matter.
What sort of falling out? She asked. The analytical look had gone, subsumed by curiosity. Well, that was it. I could either say, ask your father, and she bloody would, or I could bite the bullet and hope for the best. While I was still trying to make up my mind, though, she went on to the next thought. If Da would mind about your writing to Lord John, why wouldn't he mind me doing it? She asked reasonably. She laid the drawing on the counter where I could see it clearly. The little apes all looked like Mandy. Because he theoretically wouldn't know I told you there was a falling out to begin with. And with luck, he might not find out you'd written it. The room was warm with sunlight, but I was feeling uncomfortably hot, my clothes prickling and wilting on my skin. Okay, she said after a moment's thought, and reached for a quill. I'll do it right now. But, she said, pointing the quill at me, unless you tell me what this is all about, I'm asking Lord John. He'll tell me. He bloody well might. He told Jamie, for God's sake. Fine, I said, and closed my eyes. He married me when we thought Jamie was dead. Total silence. I opened my eyes to find Bree staring at me, both eyebrows raised, her face completely blank with incomprehension. And then I remembered my conversation with Fanny. I thought she would keep quiet about the conclusion she'd drawn, but if she didn't... And I slept with him. But it's not what you think. At this inauspicious moment, Jamie walked past the window with Sean McHugh. They were talking, both of them looking upward, Jamie pointing at something on the upper story. Brianna made a noise as though she'd tried to swallow a pawpaw whole, and Jamie glanced in at us, startled. I felt as though I'd swallowed a hand grenade, but I hastily pounded Brianna on the back, making an "it's nothing" gesture at Jamie. He frowned, but McHugh said something and he glanced away, then back at me, still frowning. I waved him away more firmly, but he said, "A moment, Harwich," over his shoulder to Sean, and strode toward the window. "Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I muttered under my breath, and thought I heard a strangled laugh from Brianna. "Is the lass all right?" Jamie asked, thrusting his head through the window and lifting his chin at Bree, who was huddled on her stool, gasping a little. "Fine," she croaked. "Swallowed something." She waved feebly at the counter, where a mug of something sat among the scatter of dried herbs and crockery. He lifted one eyebrow, but didn't pursue the matter, instead turning to me. "Can you come up? Georgie's smashed his thumb with a hammer. He says it's naught, but it looks sideways to me." I felt as though I'd just run a mile on a full stomach. "All right," I said, wiping my sweaty palms on my apron. I glanced over my shoulder. "Bree, I'll be right back." The scarlet was fading from her face. "Mm-hmm." She coughed and took a deep breath. "Don't fall off the roof." Brianna picked up the sketch of a potential schoolhouse and stared at it for a minute, but she wasn't seeing windows and benches. She was, with a mixture of horror and profound curiosity, envisioning her mother in bed with Lord John Grey. "How on earth did that happen?" she asked the sketch. She set it down again and turned to look out the window, now empty and tranquil, with its view of the long slope that fell away below the house, filled with flowering grass and clumps of dogwood. "And how in bloody hell am I ever going to be able to look John Grey in the eye next time I see him?" For that matter, looking her father in the eye. Okay, she could see why Da would have a problem with her mother writing to John Grey. Despite her perturbation, a shocked giggle escaped her, and she clapped a hand to her mouth. "I do like women," he told her once, exasperated. "I admire and honour them, and for several of the sex I feel considerable affection, your mother among them, though I doubt the sentiment is reciprocated." Her diaphragm gave a small disconcerted lurch at that.
"Oh, really?" she murmured, recalling his last remark on the subject.
"I do not, however, seek pleasure in their beds. Do I speak plainly enough?"
"Loud and clear, your lordship," she said aloud, torn between shock and amusement. "People changed, of course, but surely not that much." She shook her head. Her breathing had slowed, but her bodice still felt too tight. She put a finger in the top of her stays to pull them out a little, and then felt the tremble in her chest.
"Oh, bloody hell,"
she whispered, and grabbed the edge of the stool to keep from falling. All the blood had left her head, and her vision had gone white. Her heart had stopped again. Literally, stopped. 1, 2, 3. Beat, goddammit, beat! In panic, she thumped the heel of her hand hard against her breastbone, and then gasped when it did start beating, with shock at the startling thud in her chest as much as with relief. And then it was off like a hare at a greyhound race, juddering in her chest, leaving her breathless and terrified, hand pressed flat to her chest. "Stop it, stop it, stop it," she whispered through clenched teeth. It had stopped before, the racing. It would stop again. But it didn't. "Bree, where did you—" "Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ." Her mother was suddenly there, snatching the crumpled paper out of her hand, seizing her with a strong arm round her waist. "Down," her mother said, calm and authoritative. "Sit all the way down. Yes, that's it." Her skirts bloomed around her as she sank to the floor, a yellowish cloud flickering through the white haze. Hands braced flat on the floor, she resisted her mother's pressure to lie down, shaking her head.
"No."
She didn't seem to have any connection with her voice, but she heard it, hoarse but clear.
"Be okay. It's okay."
"All right."
A creak of boards, her mother eased down beside her, and she heard the scrape of a wooden cup against the floorboards. Warmth. Her mother's hand wrapped round her wrist, a thumb moving in search of a pulse.
"Good luck with that one," she thought muzzily.
But as she thought it, the racing eased. A confused halt, one or two random beats, and then her heart quietly resumed its normal operations, as though nothing had happened. It had, though. And she lifted her head to find her mother's eyes fixed on her face with a look of intent thoughtfulness she knew all too well. The heron.
"I'm fine," she said firmly, trying anyway. I just got light-headed for a minute."
One of her mother's brows twitched up, but Claire said nothing. Her hand was still wrapped around Brianna's telltale wrist.
"Really, it's nothing," she said, detaching herself from her mother's grip.
Each time, she told herself, it was nothing.
"When did it start?"
Claire's eyes were normally a soft amber, except when she was being a doctor. Then they went a sharp, dark pupil yellow, like the eyes of a bird of prey.
"When you told me you..." "Jesus, did you just tell me..."
Brianna got her feet under her and rose. Cautiously, but her heart went on quietly beating, just as it should.
"It's nothing."
"Yes, I did, and I don't mean this time," her mother said dryly, rising too. "When did it first happen?"
She debated lying, but the urge to keep denying that anything was truly amiss was fading fast against the need, the hope, of being reassured.
"Right after we came through the stones on Ocracoke, it was... I didn't think I'd make it."
The giddiness threatened to come back with a memory of that... that... Her gorge rose suddenly, and she leaned over and threw up a light spatter of half-digested porridge on the clean new boards of the surgery.
"Dear me."
Her mother's voice was mild.
"You aren't pregnant, are you?"
"Don't even think it."
She shuddered, wiping her mouth on her apron.
"I can't be." She hadn't even thought of the possibility and wasn't about to start. She was already haunted by the idea that she might die and leave Jem and Mandy. "On Ocracoke," she repeated, getting hold of herself. "I came out of the stones with Mandy in my arms. I couldn't see. It was all black and white spots, and I thought I was going to faint, and then I sort of did. I was lying on the ground, and I still had hold of Mandy. She was fighting to get loose and yelling, 'Mummy, Mummy!' But I couldn't answer her, and then I realized my heart wasn't beating. I thought I was dying." She smelled something sweet and pungent, and her mother wrapped Bree's fingers around a cup and guided it to her lips. "You're not going to die," her mother said, with a welcome tone of conviction. Bree nodded, wanting to believe it, even though her heart was still skipping beats, leaving moments of emptiness in her chest. She sipped the liquid. It was whiskey, sweetened with honey, and with something herbal and very fragrant in it. She closed her eyes and concentrated on taking slow sips, willing things to settle down, to go back to normal. Her surroundings were beginning to come back. The sun from the big window fell warm on her shoulders. How often has it happened? She swallowed, savoring the sweetness that was seeping into her bloodstream, and opened her eyes. 4 times before now, at Ocracoke, then again the next night. We were camping on the road. She flinched at the memory, lying rigid on the ground next to Roger, the children asleep between them. Her heart racing, fists clenched not to grab Roger's arm and shake him awake. That was bad. It went on for hours, or at least it seemed like hours. It stopped finally just before dawn. She'd felt wrung out, limp as the dew-damp clothes that wrapped her limbs. She still remembered the terrible effort needed to rise to put one foot in front of the other. The next time had been a week later on a barge in the Yadkin River, and the last before this on the road from Cross Creek to Salisbury. Those weren't so bad, just a few minutes like this one. She took another sip, held it in her mouth, then swallowed and looked up at her mother. "Do you know what it is?" Her mother was wiping up the last of the vomit from the raw floorboards, lips compressed, a pair of vertical lines visible between her soft brows. "There's a limit to what I can say for certain, lacking an EKG," Claire said, eyes on the cloth she was using. "But speaking very generally, it sounds as though you're exhibiting something called atrial fibrillation. It's not life-threatening," she added quickly, looking up and seeing the alarm on Bree's face. Her heart had given a sort of flopping leap at her mother's words and was beating now in what seemed a tentative fashion. Her knees were quivering, and she sat down quite suddenly. Her mother dropped the cloth, got down beside her, and pulled her close. Her face was half buried in her mother's coarse grey apron, smelling of grease and rosemary, soft soap and cider. The smell of the cloth, of Mama's body, brought helpless tears to her eyes. Maybe it wasn't life-threatening, but she could tell that it wasn't nothing either. "It's going to be all right," her mother whispered into her hair. "It'll be all right, baby." She was clutching her mother's arm, hard, the slender bone a life raft. If anything happens, you'll take care of the kids for me?" It wasn't a question, and her mother didn't take it as one. "Yes," she said without hesitation, and the quivering sensation eased in Bree's chest. She was breathing hard, but there didn't seem room enough for air. "Okay," she said. She could feel her fingers trembling on her mother's arm and with an effort let go. "Okay," she said again, and sitting up straight, pushed her hair out of her face. "Okay, now what?" Lub-dub, lub-dub. The meaty sounds of a healthy heart would clear through my wooden Pinard stethoscope. Beating a little faster than normal, and no wonder, but healthy. I straightened up, and Bree instantly clutched the neck of her blouse closed, her face tensed. "Your heart sounds perfect, darling," I said. "I'm sure that it's a bit of atrial fibrillation, but that's just a matter of stray electrical impulses. You aren't going to have a heart attack or anything of that sort." The tension in her face eased, and my own heart clenched a little. "Well, thank God for that." A thick lock of hair had come loose from its ribbon, and I saw that her hand was trembling as she brushed it back from her face. "But is it going to keep happening?"
"I don't know."
"Aside from bad news, I don't know is the worst thing a doctor can say to a patient, but unfortunately the most usual thing too." I took a deep breath and turned to my medicine shelves. "Oh, God," Bree said, the genuine apprehension in her voice tinged with reluctant amusement. "You're getting out the whiskey. It must be serious."
"Well, if you don't want any, I do," I said.
I'd chosen the good stuff, the Jamie Fraser special, rather than the strictly medicinal whiskey I gave the patients, and the scent of it rose warm and lively, displacing the smells of turpentine, scorched metal, and pollen-laced dust. "Oh, I'm pretty sure I do." She took the tin cup and inhaled the comforting fumes, her eyes closing involuntarily and her face relaxing. "So," she said, raising an eyebrow, "what do you know?" I rolled my own whiskey slowly round my tongue, then swallowed too. "Well, as I said, atrial fibrillation is a matter of irregular electrical impulses. Your heart muscle is sound, but it's, once in a while, getting its signals crossed, so to speak. Normally, all the muscle fibres in your atria contract at once, when they don't get a synchronized message from the electrical node in your heart that supplies them. They contract more or less at random." Brianna swallowed another sip, nodding. "That's pretty much what it feels like, all right. But you said it's not dangerous. It's freaking scary." I hesitated a fraction of a second too long. No one but Jamie was more sensitive to the transparency of my face, and I saw the alarm rise again at the back of her eyes. "It's not very dangerous," I said hastily. "And you're young and very fit. It's much less likely." "What's less likely?" She put down the cup agitated and glanced involuntarily up at the ceiling. Mandy was back in the children's room just overhead, loudly singing Frère Jacques to her doll, Esmeralda. "Well, stroke. If the atria don't contract properly for too long, they're meant to squeeze blood down into the ventricles. The right ventricle pumps blood to the lungs, the left to the rest of the body." Seeing her ruddy brows draw together, I cut to the chase. "Blood can pool in the atria long enough that it forms a clot, and if so, it might dissolve before it gets out into the body, but if not... curtains?" She took a much bigger gulp of her drink. She'd been pale as a fish belly after the attack, and looked much the same way now. "Or just being disabled so I drool and can't talk and people have to feed me and drag me around and wipe my butt?" "It's not likely to happen," I said, as reassuringly as possible, which under the circumstances was not all that reassuring. I could visualize the hideous possible outcomes as well as she was obviously doing. Somewhat better, in fact, as I'd actually seen a good many people suffering the after effects of stroke, including death. I had a momentary absurd impulse to tell her a fascinating fact about men who die of stroke, but this wasn't the time. "So, what can you do about it?" she asked, straightening up and firming her lips. I saw her eyes turn toward the bulk of the new Merck's manual, and I handed it to her. "I'm not sure," I said. "Have a look." I wasn't hopeful, given what atrial fibrillation actually was, an intermittent derangement of the heart's electrical system. "I mean," I said, watching her thumb through the book, brows furrowed, "you can stop a severe attack, one that goes on for days." "For days," she blurted, looking up wide-eyed.
I patted the air. You don't have that sort of fibrillation, I assured her.
Mind, you can always develop it.
You just have the minor, paroxysmal kind that comes and goes and may just disappear altogether one day.
And God, please, please let it do just that.
But for a severe attack, the normal treatment in the 1960s was to administer an electric shock to the heart with paddles applied to the chest. That makes the fibrillating stop and the heart start working normally again.
Most of the time.
Which we plainly can't do here, Bree said, looking round the surgery as though estimating its resources. No, but I repeat, you don't have anything as severe as that. You won't need it. My mouth had dried at the remembered visions of cardioversion. Even when it worked, I'd seen a patient shock repeatedly, the poor body seized by electricity and jerked high into the air to fall back limp and tortured onto the table, only to face another round when the EKG pen fluttered like a seismograph. I gulped the rest of my whiskey, coughed, and set down the cup.
Does it say anything helpful?
No, she said, closing the book. Her tone was deliberately casual, but I could see clearly how shaken she was. It's just the same as you said, administration of electric shock. I mean, they do have a medicine that they say works sometimes on some patients, but I'm sure that isn't anything we can manage here either.
Digitalis?
I shook my head. Penicillin was one thing, and even that was by no means dependable. I still had no way of producing a standard dosage or of telling whether a given batch of the stuff was even potent.
No, I said regretfully. I mean, you can extract digitalin from foxglove leaves, and people do. But it's dreadfully dangerous, because you can't predict the dosage, and even a bit too much will kill you.
And we do have a few things to hand.
I tried to sound brightly helpful.
We'll make sure to keep a good stock of the white willow tea on hand. It's the most powerful. White willow didn't grow in North Carolina, but was reasonably available from city apothecaries. And I had a good stock that Jamie had brought me from Salisbury.
Tea? She asked skeptically.
As a matter of fact, the active principle in willow bark tea is exactly the same chemical that you find in aspirin. And while people mostly use it for pain relief, it has the interesting side effect of thinning the blood.
Oh. So, if my heart starts twitching, I should brew up a cup of willow bark tea and it will at least keep my blood from clotting.
She was trying to keep her dubious tone, but I could see that a tiny ray of hope had been kindled. Now it was my job to blow on it and try to encourage it to take hold and burn.
Yes, exactly.
Now, the tea won't do away with the disturbing symptoms, but there are a few sorts of ad hoc things you can try for those.
Such as?
Well, plunging the face into cold water sometimes works.
Or so you're told.
I bet you've never seen anybody do that, have you?
She was definitely interested, though.
In fact, I have. At l'Hôpital des Anges in Paris. Plunging various body parts in cold or sometimes hot water was a widely prescribed treatment for a lot of different maladies at the hôpital, water being both widely available and cheap. And surprisingly, it often worked, at least in the short term. Or, if you happen not to be near any cold water, you can try one of the vagal manoeuvres. That caught her unaware, and she gave me a cat-eyed look.
If you mean having sex... Not vaginal manoeuvres, I said, though I'd think the fibrillating might be too distracting to want to do that in any case.
I said vagal manoeuvres, as in stimulating the vagus nerve. There are a few different ways of doing that, but the simplest and probably the best is something called the Valsalva manoeuvre. That sounds rather grand, but it's basically just taking a deep breath and holding it as though you were trying to cure hiccups. Then pressing your abdominal muscles down as hard as you can, like trying to force out an uncooperative bowel movement while holding your breath.
She gave me a long, considering stare, exactly the sort of look Jamie would have given me in receipt of this sort of advice. Deeply suspicious that I was practicing upon him, but inwardly fearful that I wasn't.
"Well, that should make me very popular at parties," she said.
Chapter 37. Maneuvers beginning with the letter V. Neither Jamie nor I had said anything to each other regarding Lord John Grey, sexual jealousy, or general pig-headedness since he had stamped off in the midst of our argument, whether to put a stop to the argument or merely in order to muffle the urge to throttle me. I didn't know. He'd been perfectly calm and outwardly amiable when he came in for supper, but I bloody knew him. He bloody knew me too. And we lay down to sleep side by side, wishing each other good night and Erkava, respectively, turning our backs on each other, and took turns breathing heavily until we fell asleep, me thinking that whichever sage had urged not letting the sun go down on your wrath obviously didn't know any Scots. I'd meant to find him alone and have it out with him the next day, but what with the roof, Geordie McHugh's smashed thumb, and the worrying news of Brianna's disturbed heartbeat, there hadn't been an opportunity. Supper was outwardly peaceful. There was no company, no culinary disasters, and no emergencies like one of the children catching fire, which had actually happened to Mandy a few days before, though she'd been saved by Jamie, noticing her dress sparking, whereupon he dived across the table, tackled her, rolled her on the hearthrug, and then picked her up and stuffed her into the water-filled cauldron, which was half full of sliced potatoes and carrots, but fortunately not yet boiling. She and Esmeralda had emerged from the ordeal dripping, hysterical, and slightly singed around the edges, but basically sound. I was feeling slightly singed around the edges myself, and was determined to extinguish the smouldering embers we were presently walking on. So when we rose from supper, I left the dishes on the table and invited Jamie to come for a stroll with me, ostensibly in search of a night-blooming begonia I'd found. Fanny, who had some idea of what a begonia was, glanced sharply at me, then Jamie, then down at her empty plate with her face studiously blank. "Are begonias the stuff you plant around the privy?" he asked, breaking the silence in which we'd come from the house. We were passing the main house privy at the moment, and the bitter scent of tomatoes had begun to overwhelm the heady smell of jasmine.
"Is that what I smell?"
"No, that's jasmine. The flowers don't bloom past August, though, so I have tomato plants coming up under the vines. Tomato plants have a strong scent, and it comes from the leaves, so you have that almost up until the truly cold weather, when nothing smells anyway, because it's all frozen."
"So is anyone who spends more than 30 seconds in a privy in January," Jamie said. "You wouldn't linger to smell flowers when you think your shit might turn to ice before you've got it all the way out."
I laughed, and felt the tension between us ease, feeble as the joke was. He wanted to resolve it too, then. "One of the unappreciated aspects of female clothes," I said, "insulation. When the temperature goes down, you just add another petticoat. Or two. Of course," I added, looking back at the house to be sure we hadn't picked up any outriders, "not having private parts that can be exposed to the elements is rather a help too." A sliver of moon gleamed briefly on the top rail of the paddock, the wood polished by long use. Beyond, the house was huge against the half-dark sky, only a few of the lower windows lit. Solid and handsome, like the man who'd made it. I stopped by the paddock fence and turned to face him. "I could have lied, you know."
"No, you couldn't. You can't lie to anybody, Sassanach, let alone me. And given that his lordship had already told me the truth."
"You wouldn't have been sure it was the truth," I said, "given what both parties told me about that fight."
I could have told you John was talking out of his backside because he wanted to annoy you, and you wouldn't have believed me.
You could choose your words a wee bit more care, Sassenach, he said, a hint of grimness in his voice.
I dinna want to hear anything about his lordship's backside.
Why do you think I would have believed you, though? I never believe anything you tell me that I haven't seen with my own eyes.
Now who's being annoying? I said, rather coldly. And you would have believed me, because you would have wanted to. And don't tell me otherwise, because I won't believe that.
He made a ha sort of sound under his breath. We were leaning back against the paddock rails, and the smells of jasmine, tomatoes, and human excrement had been replaced with the sweeter odour of manure and the slow, heavy exhalations of the forest beyond, the spiciness of dying leaves overlaid by the sharp, clean resins of the firs and pines.
"Why didn't you lie, then?" he asked after a long silence. "If you thought I'd believe it."
I paused, choosing my words. The air was still and warm and filled with cricket songs.
"Find me. Come to me. Love me."
"Stridulations of the heart?"
Or merely grasshopper lust.
"Because I promised you honesty a long time ago," I said, "and if honesty turns out to be a double-edged sword, I think the wounds are usually worth it."
"Did Frank think that?"
I inhaled very slowly and held the breath until I saw spots at the corners of my eyes.
"You'd have to ask him that," I said very precisely. "This is about you and me."
"And his lordship."
I lost the temper I'd been holding. "What the bloody hell do you want me to say? That I wish I hadn't slept with John?"
"Do you?"
"Actually," I said through my teeth, "given the situation, or what I thought the situation was."
He was no more than a tall black shape against the night, but I saw him turn sharply toward me.
"If ye say no, Sassenach, I may do something I'll regret. So dinna say it, aye?"
"What's wrong with you? You forgave me. You said so."
"No, I didn't. I said I'd love you forever, and I will, but..."
"You can't love somebody if you won't bloody forgive them."
"I forgive you," he said.
"How fucking dare you?" I shouted, turning on him with clenched fists.
"What's wrong with you?"
He made a grab for my arm, but I jerked away from him.
"First you're angry because I didn't say I forgave you, and now you're outraged because I did?"
"Because I didn't do anything wrong to start with, you fat-headed asshole, and you know it. How dare you try to forgive me for something I didn't do?"
"You did do it."
"I didn't. You think I was unfaithful to you, and I, bloody, wasn't."
I was shrieking loudly enough to drown out the crickets and shaking with rage. There was a long moment of silence in which the crickets cautiously tuned up again. Jamie turned to the fence and gripped the top rail and shook it violently, making the wood creak.
He might be speaking Gaelic, but whatever he was saying sounded like an enraged wolf.
I stood still, panting. The night was warm and humid and sweat was beginning to bloom on my body. I ripped off my shawl and threw it over the fence. I could hear Jamie breathing too, fast and deep, but he was standing still now, gripping the fence rail, his shoulders stiff, head bent.
"You want to ken what's wrong with me?"
he asked at last. His voice was pitched low, but it wasn't calm. He straightened up, looming in the moonlight.
"I swear to myself, I will put this thing out of my head, and mostly I manage. But then that sodomite sends me a letter out of the blue, just as though it never happened, and it's all back again."
His voice shook, and he stopped for a second, shaking his head violently as though to clear it.
"And when I think of it, and then I see you, I want to have you then and there. You rouse me, whether you're slicing cucumbers or bathing naked in the creek with your hair loose. I want you bad, Sassenach,
but he's there in my head, and if...
Lost for words, he smashed a fist down on the fence rail, and I felt the wood tremble by my shoulder.
If I canna stand the notion that you and he were fucking me behind my back, how do you think I can stand to think that you and I are sharing a bed with him in it?
I would have hammered the fence myself, save for knowing it would hurt. Instead, I rubbed my hands hard over my face and dug my fingers into my scalp, scattering hairpins. I stood there, puffing.
"We're not," I said, in a tone of complete certainty.
"We're not, because I'm not. I have never, not for one second, thought of anyone but you when I've been in your bed. And I ought to be really offended at the notion that you do, but I don't."
He gulped air and took me by the arms. "I don't, Claire. It's only that I'm afraid I might."
I felt dizzy from hyperventilation and put my own hands flat on his chest to steady myself, and smelled the sudden, pungent musk of his body, the waves of it, an acrid hot ghost surrounding us.
I did rouse him.
"I tell you what," I said at last, and lifted my head to look at him. It was full dark now, but my eyes were well enough adapted as to see his face, his eyes searching mine. "I tell you what," I said again, and swallowed.
"You leave that to me."
He trembled slightly. It might have been a buried laugh.
"You think highly of yourself, Sassenach,"
he said, his voice husky.
"You think a warm place to stick my cock's enough to make me forget."
I stared at him. "What on earth do you mean by that, you—" Words failed me, and I jerked loose, flapping my arms in bewildered frustration. "Why would you say something like that? You know it isn't true." He scratched his jaw. I could hear the whiskers rasp.
"No, it isn't," he agreed. "I was just trying to think of something offensive enough to say as to make you strike me."
I actually did laugh, though more from surprise than real humour.
"Don't tempt me.
Why do you want me to hit you?" He rocked back on his heels and looked me over slowly, from undone hair to battered moccasins, and back.
"Well, in about 10 seconds I mean to lay you on your back in the grass, lift your skirts, and address you with a certain amount of forcefulness. I thought I'd feel better about doing that if you provoked me first."
"Me? Provoke you?" I stood stock still for 3 of those seconds, blood thundering in my ears and pulsing through my fingers. Then I walked toward him. 7, I said. 6, and I reached for the neck of his shirt. 5.
4.
I yanked it down, said 3, rather loudly, leaned forward and bit his nipple. Not a teasing love bite either. He yelped, jerked back, grabbed me, and with a big hand gripping the back of my head, pushed my face into his. Our mouths collided messily and stayed that way, open, voracious, amorous, seeking as much as kissing, lips, ears, noses, tongues and teeth, hands groping and snatching and pulling and rubbing. I found his cock and rubbed it hard through his breeches, and he made a deep growling sound and grasped my buttocks, and then we were in the grass, in a tangle of knees and limbs and rumpled clothes and hot flesh bared to the starry sky.
It seemed to last a long time, though it couldn't have.
I came back to myself slowly, reverberations passing through me in a slow, pleasant throb.
Provocation, forsooth.
He was lying on his back next to me, face turned to the moon, eyes closed, and breathing like one rescued from the sea. His right hand was still between my thighs, and I was curled beside him, the walls of his ear, beautiful as a seashell, a few inches from my mouth.
"Have we got that out of our system, do you think?" I said drowsily.
hour.
His right hand twitched, but he didn't pull it away.
Hour.
He sighed deeply and turned his head toward me, opening his eyes.
We have.
He smiled a little and closed his eyes again, his chest rising and falling under my hand. I could feel his nipple through his shirt, small and still hard against my palm. Did I break the skin?
You do that every time you touch me, Sassanach. I'm no bleeding, though.
We lay in silence for some time, and the sounds of crickets and the rustle of leaves flowed over us like water. He spoke, quietly, and I turned my head, thinking I hadn't heard him aright. But I had. I just didn't know what language he was speaking.
That isn't Gaelic, is it?
I asked dubiously, and he shook his head slowly, eyes still closed.
Gaelic, he said. Irish. I heard it from Stephen O'Farrell during the rising. It just came back to me now. My body is out from my control, he said softly. She was the half of my body, the very half of my soul.
Chapter 38 Grim Reaper. I was digging up a number of four-leaved milkweeds with the intent of transplanting them to my garden when I heard the unmistakable bray of an annoyed mule. I'd had enough experience with Clarence and a few of his fellows to tell the difference between a call of greeting and a declaration of hostility, both ear-splitting but different. A couple of male voices and another mule now joined the argument. Hastily tucking the uprooted milkweeds into the wet moss in my basket, I picked up said basket and went to see what was happening. Neither of the voices sounded familiar, and I stopped short of the racket, peering through a screen of silver firs and tall, skinny aspens. Two men, two mules all right, but one of the mules, a light bay, had turned aside and was browsing on the flowering grass by the trail, while the other, darker mule, was fiercely resisting the efforts of the two men to force him. I checked. Yes, it was a him, to continue up the narrow, rocky defile. Frankly, I didn't blame the mule in the slightest. He and his fellow were both heavily laden, each with a long wooden crate slung on each side, and large canvas-covered bundles tied messily to a pack frame on top. I could guess what had happened. There was a good wide trail that led up this side of the cove, but it branched at a spot called Wounded Lady, which was a small, brilliantly blue spring with a single aspen on its edge, white-barked and solid, but with trails of blood-red sap trickling slowly from the wounds inflicted by burrowing insects and the woodpeckers hunting them. The main trail made a sharp turn and went on to the east, while a narrower deer path, much obstructed by growth and rolling stones, went straight up the right side of the aspen. The lead mule had either stumbled on rocks or been caught by the branches of the trees that edged the path. Whatever had caused it, the bindings of his baggage had broken or slipped, and half the load was hanging down over his tail, scattering small boxes and leather bags, with one of the long boxes resting with one end on the ground, the other pointing at the sky, and a fragile strand of rope still anchoring it to the mule. I had seen the sort of cases used to ship firearms many times. In France, in Scotland, in America. It didn't matter what the time period. A bang stick is a bang stick, and you need a long, narrow box if you want to carry a large number of them. I didn't recognize either of the men, and I didn't wait about to introduce myself. I took myself and my milkweeds off as fast as I could go. Luckily, I found Jamie within half an hour, passing the time of day with Tom MacLeod, the coffin maker. "Who's dead?" I gasped, out of breath from scrambling down the mountain.
"No one yet," Jamie said, eyeing me. "But you look like you're about to be, Sassanach. What's happened?"
I set my basket on a sawhorse, sat down on another, and told them, pausing to gasp for breath or gulp water from the canteen Tom handed me.
"Nothing up that path but Captain Cunningham's place, is there?" Tom observed. "You mean they maybe didn't go up that way by accident, eh?"
Jamie stuck his head out of a coffin shed and looked up at the sky.
"It's going to rain soon. Be a pity if our friends find themselves stuck in the mud."
Tom grunted in approval, and without further consultation went into his house, returning in less than a minute with an old leather hat on his head, a good rifle in his hand, a pistol in his belt, and a cartridge box slung over his bowed shoulder. He had a second pistol in his other hand, which he gave Jamie. Jamie nodded, checked the priming, and stuck it in his own belt. Absently touching his dirk, he nodded to me.
"Go get young Ian, will you, Sassenach? I saw him mowing in his upper field not an hour since."
"But what—"
"Go," he said, though mildly. "Dinna fash, Sassenach. It'll be fine."
I found young Ian, not in his upper field, but in the woods nearby, rifle in hand. "Don't shoot," I called, spotting him through the brush. "It's me."
"I couldna mistake you for anything save a small bear or a large hog, auntie," he assured me, as I poured my way through a clump of dogwood toward him. "And I dinna want either one of those today."
"Fine. How about a nice fat pair of gun runners?" I explained as well as I could while jog-trotting along behind him as he detoured through the field in order to grab his scythe, which he thrust into my hands. "I dinna think you'll have to use it, auntie," he said, grinning at the look on my face. "But if you stand there blocking the trail, it would be a desperate man would try to go through you." When we arrived, we discovered that the trail had already been effectively blocked by the first mule's burden, which he had succeeded in shedding completely. When Ian and I showed up a little way below the gunrunners, the first mule, enjoying his new lightness of spirit, was nimbly climbing over the pile of bags, boxes, and wickerwork toward us, intent on joining his fellow, who was not letting his own pack stop him from browsing a large patch of blackberry brambles that edged the trail just there. Evidently, we had arrived almost at the same time as Jamie and Tom MacLeod, for the two gunrunners had turned to gawk at me and Ian just as Jamie and Tom came into sight on the trail above them.
"Who the devil are you?" one of the men demanded, looking from me to Ian in bewilderment.
Ian had tied up his hair in a topknot to keep it out of the way while mowing, and without his shirt, deeply tanned and tattooed, he looked very like the Mohawk he was. I didn't want to think what I must look like, comprehensively dishevelled, and with my hair full of leaves and coming down, but I gripped my scythe and gave them a stern look.
"I'm Ian Og Murray," Ian said mildly, and nodded at me. "And that's my auntie. Whoops!"
The first mule was nosing his way determinedly between us, causing us both to step off the path.
"I'm Ian Murray," Ian repeated,
stepping back, his rifle in a relaxed but definitely ready position, across his chest.
"And I," said a deep voice from above, "am Colonel James Fraser of Fraser's Ridge, and that's my wife."
He moved into sight, broad-shouldered and tall against the light, with Tom behind him, sunlight glinting off his rifle.
"Catch that mule, will you, Ian? This is my land. And who, may I ask, are you gentlemen?"
The men jerked in surprise and whirled to look upward, though one cast an apprehensive glance over his shoulder to keep an eye on the threat to the rear.
We're...
The young man, he couldn't be much more than 20, exchanged a panicked look with his older companion.
"I am Lieutenant Felix Summers, sir, of His Majesty's Ship Revenge."
Tom made a noise that might have been either menace or amusement.
"Who's your friend, then?" he asked, nodding at the older gentleman, who might have been anything from a town vagrant to a backwoods hunter, but who looked somewhat the worse for drink, his nose and cheeks webbed with broken capillaries.
"I believe his name is Voules, sir," the lieutenant said. "He is not my friend."
His face had gone from a shocked white to a prim pink.
"I hired him in Salisbury to assist with
with my baggage.
I see,
Jamie said politely.
Are you perhaps lost, Lieutenant? I believe the nearest ocean is roughly 300 miles behind you.
I am on leave from my ship, the young man said, regaining his dignity. I have come to visit someone.
No prize for guessing who, Tom said to Jamie, and lowered his rifle. What do you want to do with him, Jamie? My wife and I will take the lieutenant and his man down to the house for some refreshment, Jamie said, bowing graciously to Summers. Would you maybe help Ian with...
He nodded toward the chaos scattered among the rocks. And Ian, once you've got things in hand, go up and bring Captain Cunningham down to join us, will you? Summers picked up the subtle difference between invite and bring, just as well as Ian did, and stiffened, but he had little choice. He did have a pistol and an officer's dirk in his belt, but I could see that the former wasn't primed and therefore likely wasn't loaded either, and I doubted that he'd ever drawn his dirk with any motive beyond polishing it. Jamie didn't even glance at the weapons, let alone ask for their surrender.
I thank you, sir, Summers said,
turned on his heel, and shying only slightly as he passed me and my scythe, started down the trail, back stiff. It was nearly supper time when Captain Cunningham arrived, not quite in young Ian's custody, but definitely in his company, and not that pleased about it. I'd fortunately had time to wash, comb oak leaves and spruce needles out of my hair, and generally put myself to rights, while Jamie sat Lieutenant Summers and Mr. Vools down in the parlour and offered them beer. Vools accepted eagerly, Summers reluctantly, but they drank it, and now 2 hours and 4 quarts of beer later, they were, if not happy, somewhat more relaxed.
Who are those men?
Fanny whispered to me, coming back to the kitchen after another beer delivery.
They don't seem to like Mr. Fraser much.
Friends of Captain Cunningham, I said. I think the captain will be joining them shortly. Do we have anything they can eat? Men are always easier to handle if their stomachs are full.
That's true, she said, nodding sagely. A first-rate brothel has a good cook. But you can't let a man eat too much if you want him to do anything. Mother Abbott said, if a man's belly sticks out so far he can't see his cock, you'd best give him enough wine that he falls asleep, and then tell him he had a good time when he wakes up.
How about the game pie Mrs. Chisholm sent down? I interrupted hastily. Is there any of that left? I told Fanny she could tell me anything, and I'd meant it. But I was occasionally still disconcerted by the vivid detail of her recollections. The captain definitely had a lean and hungry look. Such men are dangerous, I murmured, watching as he strode into the parlour, young Ian at his heels like a genial wolf. Then I caught a glimpse of Jamie rising to greet Cunningham and thought, and he's not the only one. I left Fanny to deal with the game pie, and followed the men into the parlour with a tray holding a bottle of the JFS whiskey, a small pitcher of water, and 5 of our best glasses, these being the heavy-bottomed small glasses known as shot glasses, as they made a sound strongly resembling a pistol shot when slammed on the table following a toast. I hoped there would still be 5 of them after this little social gathering. "Captain," I said, smiling pleasantly as I set the tray down, "how nice to see you." He glared at me, but was too well-bred to say what he was patently thinking. I wasn't sure whether my presence would make things better or worse, but Jamie cut his eyes briefly sideways, indicating that said presence wouldn't be required, so I curtsied to the assembled and walked down the hall to the kitchen, where I took my shoes off and crept back quietly in my stocking feet, much to Fanny's amusement.
I imagine my nephew told you the circumstances in which we encountered your acquaintances this afternoon,
Jamie was saying in a pleasant tone of voice. There was a splashing sound and the clink of glasses.
Circumstances, Cunningham repeated sharply. Lieutenant Summers was a close friend of my late son. We have remained in correspondence since Simon's death, and I hold Felix in the same regard as I would were he my son as well. I take considerable exception to your treatment of him and his servant, sir.
A dram wi, sir. Slangeva.
From my vantage spot flattened against the wall, I couldn't see Jamie, but I could see the captain, who looked startled at this reply to his statement.
What?
He said sharply, and looked down into his whisky glass as though it might be poisoned.
What did you say, sir?
Slangeva, Jamie repeated mildly. It means to your health.
Oh.
The captain looked at Summers, who by this point resembled a pig who had just been struck on the head with a maul.
Yes. To your health, Mr. Fraser.
Colonel Fraser, Ian put in helpfully. Slangeva. The captain threw back his dram, swallowed, and turned purple.
Perhaps a bit of water, Captain.
I saw Jamie's arm stretch out, pitcher in hand.
It's said to open the flavour of the whisky, Ian.
Ian took the pitcher and deftly mixed a fresh drink, half water this time, for the captain, who took it, eyes watering.
I repeat, sir, he said hoarsely, I take exception.
Well, so do I, sir,
Jamie said in the same amiable tone.
And I think any self-respecting man would do the same at discovering a martial enterprise taking place under his nose, upon his land, without warning or notice. Do you not agree?
I do not pretend to understand what you mean by a martial enterprise, Colonel. Cunningham had got hold of himself and sat up straight as a poker. Lieutenant Summers has had the kindness to bring me some supplies I had requested from friends in the Navy.
I did wonder, Ken, why a Lowlander, and especially one who's a naval captain, should choose Fraser's Ridge to settle,
Jamie said, interrupting him.
And why you should have wanted land so far up the ridge, for that matter.
But, of course, your place is nae more than 10 miles from the Cherokee villages, isn't it?
I'm sure I don't know, the captain said, but this has nothing to do...
I was an Indian agent for some time, Ken,
Jamie went on in the same mild tone, under Superintendent Johnson.
I spent considerable time with the Cherokee, and they ken me for an honest man.
I was not impugning your honesty, Colonel Fraser.
Cunningham sounded rather testy, though it was obvious that this was news to him.
I do take issue with your...
You'll ken, I suppose, that the British government has been in cahoots with various Indians in the conduct of this war, encouraging them to attack settlements suspected of rebellious persuasions, providing them with guns and powder on occasion.
No, sir.
The captain's tone had changed, his belligerence slightly tinged now with wariness.
I was not aware of that.
Jamie and Ian both made polite Scottish noises, indicating scepticism.
You'll admit that you do ken I'm a rebel, Captain.
You're fairly open about it, sir, Cunningham snapped. He sat upright, fists clenched on his knees.
I am, Jamie agreed. You make no secret of your own loyalties.
Loyalty to king and country requires neither secrecy nor defence, Colonel.
Aye? Well, I suppose that depends on whether that loyalty results in actions that might be considered injurious to me and mine, Captain. My cause or my family.
We didn't mean...
Lieutenant Summers was beginning to be alarmed. Stirred from his lethargy by the rising tone of the conversation, he made an attempt to sit up straight, his round face earnest.
We wasn't meaning to bring Indians down upon you, sir, so help me God.
Mr. Summers. The captain lifted a hand, and the lieutenant went red and subsided.
Colonel, I repeat that I make no secret of my loyalties. I preach them in public each Sunday before God and man.
I've heard ye, Jamie said dryly. And you'll notice, I suppose, that I've made nae move to hinder you doing so.
I take no issue with your opinions. Speak as you find, and let the devil listen.
I blinked,
He was angry, and was beginning to let it show.
Talk all you like, Captain, but I'll not countenance any action that threatens the Ridge.
Lieutenant Summers made a small involuntary movement, and Captain Cunningham made a short, sharp movement that silenced him.
You have my word, Colonel,
he said, between his teeth. There was a long moment of silence, and then I heard Jamie take a deep breath, this succeeded by the pouring of whiskey.
Then let us drink to the understanding between us, Captain, he said calmly,
and I heard the brief shifting and scrape of glass on wood as they all picked up their drams.
To peace, Jamie said.
He emptied his glass and slammed it on the table with a bang that startled Mr. Vools out of his stupor.
What the hell was that?
He sat up, staring blearily to and fro.
They shooting at us with our own guns?
The brief silence was broken by Jamie.
Guns? He said mildly. Did you notice any guns, Ian, when you packed up the captain's gear?
No, Uncle, Ian said in exactly the same tone. No guns. Despite its farcical aspects, the incident with the captain's guns was truly alarming. Preaching loyalty to the king in church of a Sunday was one thing. Preparing, evidently, for an armed conflict under Jamie's nose was another.
Can you evict him? I asked tentatively.
The children had all gone to bed after supper, and Jamie, me, Brianna and Roger were holding a minor council of war over dishes of corn pudding.
I could, Jamie said, frowning at the cream jug. But I've been turning it over in my mind, and I think it's maybe better to let him stay where he'll be under my eye than have him up to mischief where he's not.
What do you think he was or is planning to do?
Roger asked. I mean, it's at least possible he wanted arms for protection. His place is very near the Cherokee line.
20 muskets is maybe that wee bit excessive for keeping stray Indians out of his house, Jamie replied. If he's bought guns, he had a plan to use them.
For what, though? Does he have it in mind to try to assassinate me and burn out my tenants? What would be the point of that?
Maybe he's doing the same thing you are, Da.
Bree poured cream on her own pudding and then on Jamie's, raising a personal militia to guard his property. I glanced at Jamie. He returned the look, but shook his head almost imperceptibly and took up his spoon. While preventing attacks on the ridge was certainly one of Jamie's motives in arming some of his men, I was sure he had others. He clearly didn't feel this was the time to be telling Roger and Bree about them, though.
Ian said one of the men who brought the guns was a naval lieutenant. One of the captain's men from his career at sea, I suppose, Bree asked.
I suppose that too,
Jamie said with a certain terseness. Implying, she said, that he still has connections with the Navy, which is probably where the guns came from. Do they use muskets on ships?
Aye, they do.
Jamie shifted slightly as though his shirt was too tight, which it wasn't.
When ships come close together, fighting, the sailors take muskets up into the rigging and fire down into the other ship. The Navy has a great many guns.
How do you know that? Bree asked, curious.
I read, lass, her father said, raising one eyebrow at her. There was an account of a sea battle in the Salisbury newspaper, and a drawing showing the wee sailors up among the masts, blasting away.
Aye, well,
said Roger, spooning ripe sliced strawberries over his pudding.
I doubt Cunningham will try to bring guns up that way again. And if he does,
then he's arming us instead of himself.
Despite the seriousness of the discussion, Bree was amused. The look of amusement faded, though, and she leaned toward us.
But you'll need more guns than what you took from the captain, won't you?
I will, Jamie admitted. But it may take some time to find them, and buy the powder and shot to fire them.
Roger and Bree exchanged a look, and he nodded.
Let us help with that, Da, she said, and reaching into her pocket,
drew out three small flat strips of what could only be gold, glowing dully in the candlelight.
"Where on earth did you get those?"
I picked one up, fingering it gingerly. It was surprisingly heavy for its size. Definitely gold. "A jeweller on Newbury Street in 1980, she said. "I had 50 of these made. I sewed some into the hems of our clothes and hid others in the heels of our shoes. It only took 10 to provision us for the trip and buy passage on the ship from Scotland. There's plenty left. I mean, if you need to buy powder or anything."
"You're sure, lass?"
Jamie touched one of the slips with a forefinger.
"I've gold enough. It's just that wee bit more difficult to use,"
Slip Roger said, smiling.
"Don't fash yourself. We're honoured to help finance the revolution."
Chapter 39. I Have Returned. To Lord John Grey, in care of the commander of His Majesty's forces in Savannah, Royal Colony of Georgia. Dear Lord John, I'm back, though I suppose I should say I have returned. More dramatic, you know. I'm smiling as I write this, imagining you saying something about how lack of drama is not one of my failings. Yours either, my friend. We, my husband Roger and our two children, Jeremiah, Jem, and Amanda, Mandy, have taken up residence on Fraser's Ridge, though it's more like the residence is taking up existence around us. My father is building his own fortress. We'll be here for the foreseeable future, though I know better than most people just how little one can foresee of the future. We'll leave the details until I see you again. I would have written to you in any case, but I'm doing it today because my father received a letter 3 days ago from a young man named Judah Bixby, who was his aide-de-camp during the Battle of Monmouth. Were you involved with that one? If so, I hope you weren't hurt. Mr. Bixby wrote to tell Da that a friend of his, Dr. Denzel Hunter, had been captured in New York and is presently being held in the military prison at Stony Point. Mama says you will know perfectly well why I'm writing to you about Denzel Hunter, rather than she doing it. Da says no one needs to write to you, as Dr. Hunter's wife would surely have written to her father. Your brother, if I have things straight, already. But I agree with Mama that it's better to write, just in case Mrs. Hunter doesn't know where her husband is, or can't write to you for some other reason. All my best to you and your family, and do please give my best to your son William. I look forward to meeting him, and you, of course, again. Does one sign a letter, your most obedient, humble, etc., if one is a woman? Surely not. Yours truly, Brianna Randall Fraser Mackenzie, Mrs. P.S. Enclosed are a few sketches that I made of Newhouse, as my father calls it, in its present state of construction, as well as a brief look at the members of my family in their present states. How long has it been since you've seen either of my parents? I'm pretty sure you can tell who is who. Should that be who is whom? If so, please make the grammatical adjustment for me. Chapter 40. Black Brandy, Savannah. M, the Duke of Pardlow wrote, and then stopped. Dipping his quill again, he carefully inserted the word dear, though he was obliged to angle it upward in order to squeeze it onto the page, having begun his writing too far to the left. He stared at the blank page for a moment, then looked up to find his younger brother staring at him, one eyebrow raised. "What the devil do you want?" he snapped. "Brandy," John answered mildly. "And so do you, from the look of it. What the devil are you doing?" Crossing the room, he went down on one knee to rummage in his campaign chest, emerging with a round-bellied black bottle that sloshed in a reassuringly weighty fashion. "That's brandy. Are you sure?" Hal, nevertheless, reached round the small table on which he'd perched his writing desk and dipped into his own chest for a pair of dented pewter cups.
Stefan von Namsen said it was, John shrugged, and coming to the table, picked up Hal's penknife and started removing the wax seal from the bottle. You recall our friend the Graf von Erdberg? He says it's black brandy, to be exact.
Is it really black? Hal asked, interested. Well, the bottle is, though I gather from his letter that it's called that colloquially because it's made by a small group of monks who live on the edge of the Black Forest. Its real name is something German. Discarding the last shreds of wax, he held the bottle up close to his eyes and squinted at the handwritten label. Blut der Märtyrer. Blood of Martyrs. How jolly. Hal held out his cup, and the rich aroma of what was plainly good brandy, if perhaps a little more red than usual, he squinted into his cup, filled his nose.
You've kept up your German, then?
John glanced up from his own cup, raising the other eyebrow.
I've scarcely had time to forget it, he said. It's barely a year since Monmouth and bloody Hessians coming out of every crack in the earth. Though I suppose, he added casually, glancing away, that you mean, have I seen our friend the Graf lately? I haven't. This came with a brief note saying that Stefan was in Trier. God knows why.
Ah.
Hal took a sip of the brandy and closed his eyes, both to enhance the taste and to avoid looking at John. The brandy began to settle in John's limbs, the warmth of it softening his thoughts, and just possibly his judgment.
Have you decided to write to Minnie, then?
John's voice was casual, but the question wasn't.
I haven't.
But you...
Oh, I see. You mean you haven't quite decided, which is why you were hovering over that sheet of paper like a vulture waiting for something to die.
Hal opened his eyes and sat up straight, fixing John with a sort of look meant to shut him up like a portmanteau. John, though, picked up the bottle and refilled Hal's cup.
I know, he said simply. I wouldn't want to either. But you think Ben's really dead, then? Or are you writing to her about Dotty and her husband?
No, I bloody don't. The cup tilted in Hal's hand. He saved it with no more than a splash of brandy landing on his waistcoat, which he ignored.
I don't believe it, and I think Mrs. Mackenzie is likely right about Dotty writing to me. I want to wait until we hear from her before I alarm Minnie.
John watched this, his own expression deliberately blank.
It's only that I've never seen you begin any letter to anyone with the salutation, dear.
I don't need to, Hal said irritably. Beasley does all that nonsense when it's official.
And if it's not, whomever I'm writing to already knows who they are and what I think of them, for God's sake. Pointless affectation. I do sign them, he added, after a brief pause.
John made a non-committal hmm noise and took a swig of brandy, holding it meditatively in his mouth. The quill had made an inky spot on the table where his brother had dropped it. Seeing it, Hal stuffed the quill back into its jar and rubbed at the mark with the side of his hand.
It was just... I couldn't think how to begin, damn it.
Don't blame you.
Hal glanced at the sheet of paper with its accusatory salutation.
So I wrote M, just to get started, you know. And then I had to decide whether to go on and write out her name or leave it at M. So while I was thinking...
His voice died away, and he took a quick, convulsive swallow of the blood of martyrs. John took a somewhat more reserved mouthful, thinking of Stefan von Namsen, who wrote now and then, always addressing him with German formality as my esteemed and noble friend, though the letters themselves tended to be much less formal. Jamie Fraser's salutations ranged from the casual Dear John to the slightly warmer My dear friend, and depending upon the state of their relations, Dear Sir, or a coldly abrupt, my lord, in the other direction. Possibly Hal was right. People he wrote to never were in any doubt about what he thought of them, and the same was true of Jamie.
Perhaps it was good of Jamie to give fair warning, so you could open a bottle before reading on. The brandy was good, dark and very strong. He ought to have watered it, but given the rigidity of Hal's body, he thought that it was just as well that he hadn't. Dear M. It was true that Hal had always addressed letters to him merely as J. Just as well that Mr. Beasley, Hal's clerk, did tidy up Hal's correspondence, or the King might well have found himself addressed curtly as G, or would it be R for Rex? Absurd as it was, the thought jarred loose the memory that had been niggling at him since he'd seen the vestigial letter, and he glanced at it, and then at his brother's face. Hal had called Esme that. M, his first wife, dead in childbirth, and Hal's first child dead with her. He'd been accustomed to write notes to her beginning that way, just an M, with no other salutation. John had seen a few. Perhaps seeing the single letter, black and bold, against the white paper, had brought it all back with the unexpected suddenness of a bullet in the heart. Hal cleared his throat explosively and gulped brandy, which made him cough, sputtering amber-red droplets all over the paper. He grabbed it and crumpled it up, then tossed it into the fire where it caught and blazed up with a blue-tinged flame. "I can't," he said definitely. "I won't. I mean, I don't know that Ben's dead. Not for sure." John rubbed a hand over his face, then nodded. He himself had a very cold feeling around the heart when he thought of his eldest nephew. "All right. Is anyone else likely to tell Minnie? Adam or Henry? Or, you know, Dotty?" he added diffidently. The blood drained from Hal's face. To the best of John's knowledge, neither of Ben's brothers was a very good correspondent, but his sister Dotty was accustomed to write regularly to her mother, had in fact even written to inform her parents that she was eloping with a Quaker doctor, and becoming a rebel in the bargain. She wouldn't scruple to tell Minnie anything she thought her mother ought to know. "Dotty doesn't know either," Hal said, trying to convince himself. "All I told her was that he was missing." "Missing, presumed dead," John pointed out. "And William said..." "And where's William?" "Speaking of writing," Hal demanded, seeking refuge in hostility. "Unless you know something I don't know, he's just run off without a word." John exhaled strongly, but kept his temper. "William found good evidence that Ben didn't die at that prison camp in New Jersey," he pointed out, "and he discovered Ben's wife and child for us. He found a body in a grave with Ben's name on it, and it wasn't Ben. But for all we know, Ben is in a grave with that fellow's name on it, and whoever buried them simply muddled the bodies." Hal wanted urgently to believe that someone had buried a stranger under Ben's name. But why should anyone have done that? John picked up the thought as neatly as if Hal had stenciled it on his forehead. "They might have, but they might also have done it deliberately, buried a stranger under Ben's name. And there are any number of reasons why someone might have done that. Ben managing it to cover his escape is the best one." "I know," Hal said shortly. "No, you're right. I don't know for sure that he's dead. I wasn't going to tell Minnie that I thought he was, though I do think there's a good chance of it." He firmed his jaw as he said it. "But I have to tell her something. If I don't write fairly soon, she'll know something's wrong. She's bloody good at knowing things one doesn't want her to know." That made John laugh, and Hal huffed a little, the tension in his shoulders relaxing slightly. "Well," John suggested, "you told her that Ben had married and had a son, didn't you? Why not write and tell her you've met the girl? Amaranthus, I mean. And your presumed grandson. And invited her to take up residence here while Ben is absent. That's surely news enough for one letter." "And if Ben is dead, the knowledge that he's left a son will be some consolation." John didn't say that out loud, but the words hovered in the air between them. Hal nodded, exhaling. "I'll do that." His mind, released from immediate dread, took flight.
Do you think that fellow Penobscot, or whatever he's called, you know, Campbell's mapmaker, do you think he might be able to draw a passing likeness of young Trevor? I should like Minnie to see him.
And if anything should happen to the boy, at least we'd have that.
Alexander Penfold, you mean?
John said.
I've never seen him draw anything more complex than a compass rose, but let me ask round a bit. I might just know a decent portrait painter.
He smiled then, and lifted his newly filled cup.
To your grandson, then.
Prosit. Prosit,
Hal echoed, and drank the rest of the brandy without stopping to breathe. Chapter 41 Awkward Sod. John Gray took up his penknife, a small French thing cased in rosewood and extremely sharp, and cut a fresh quill with a sense of anticipation. In the course of his life to date, he reckoned that he'd written more than 100 letters to Jamie Fraser, and had always experienced a slight frisson at the thought of impending connection, whatever the nature of that connection might be. It always happened, no matter whether the letters were written in friendship, in affection, or in anxious warning, in anger, or in longings that went up in flames and the smell of burning, leaving bitter ash behind. This one, though, would be different. August 13th, A.D. 1779. To James Fraser, Fraser's Ridge, Royal Colony of North Carolina. He envisioned Jamie in his chosen habitat amid the wilderness, his hands hard and smooth with callus, and his hair bound back with a leather lace, companion to Indians, wolves, and bears, and companioned also by his female accoutrements, to be sure. From Lord John Gray, Oglethorpe Street, No. 12, Savannah, Royal Colony of Georgia. He wanted to begin with the salutation, "My dear Jamie," but he hadn't yet earned back the right to do that. He would, though. In another 1,000 years or so, he murmured, dipping the quill again, or maybe sooner. Ought it to be General Fraser? Ha, he muttered, no point in putting the man's back up, a priori. Mr. Fraser, I write to offer a commission of employment to your daughter. I have often spoken of her gifts as an artist to friends and acquaintances, and recently one such acquaintance, a Mr. Alfred Brumby, a merchant of Savannah, admired several sketches she had sent to me, and inquired whether I might have the goodness to perform the office of ambassador for him in obtaining your consent for your daughter to travel to Savannah in order to paint a portrait of his new wife. Brumby is a wealthy gentleman, and quite able to afford both a handsome fee, if your daughter should wish it, I would be most happy to negotiate the price for her, and the expenses of her journey and her lodgings whilst in Savannah. He smiled a little to himself at the thought of Brianna Fraser Mackenzie and Claire Fraser, and what either woman might say in answer to his offer of assistance in her affairs. I can assure you that Mr. Brumby is a gentleman, and his establishment beyond reproach, lest you fear that I propose to kidnap the young woman for my own fell purposes. Which, he murmured to himself, is exactly what I do propose to do, you awkward sod. If he'd been at all circumspect about it, Fraser would have been immediately suspicious of his motives. But in a long career of soldiery and diplomacy, he'd seen just how often the bald-faced truth, spoken in all seriousness, might be taken for a jest. He continued, tongue firm in his cheek. In all seriousness, I guarantee her safety, and that of any friend or family member you may choose to send with her. Might Jamie come himself? That would be deeply interesting. Bloody dangerous, though. In these unsettled times you will, of course, have great concern for the well-being of travellers, and it may perhaps strike you that inviting a young woman of outspoken Republican sentiments to take up temporary residence in a city presently under the control of His Majesty's army might be injudicious. With a sense of your probable feelings regarding the rebel cause,
I will spare you a full enumeration of my reasons, but I assure you there is not the slightest risk that Savannah will suffer invasion or conquest by the Americans, and Brianna will not be exposed to physical harm.
He stopped to consider, twiddling the quill. Should he mention the French?
What could Fraser possibly know already perched up there in his mountainous lair? Granted, the man wrote and presumably received letters. But given the dramatic circumstances of his resignation of his field general's commission at Monmouth, John rather doubted that Jamie was exchanging daily notes with George Washington, Horatio Gates, or any other American commander privy to such intelligence. But what if he did know that Admiral D'Estaing and his navy of frogs might possibly be hopping up onto the beaches of Charlestown or Savannah within a few weeks? He'd played chess with Jamie Fraser for years and had considerable respect for the man's abilities. Best sacrifice that particular pawn, then, to draw him away from the lurking knight.
It is true that the French...
No, wait. He paused, frowning at the half-written sentence. What if someone who was not James Fraser happened to get their hands on this missive? And here he was, putting unequivocally sensitive information directly into the hands of the rebels.
Well, that won't do. What won't do? And why aren't you dressed?
Hal had come in unnoticed and was peering at himself in the large looking-glass that reflected the French doors at the far side of the study.
Why am I bleeding?
He sounded rather startled. John took a moment to obliterate the line about the French with a quick swath of ink, then rose to inspect his brother, who was in fact oozing blood from a deep scrape just in front of his left ear. He was trying to stop the blood getting onto his stock, but didn't appear to have a handkerchief available for the purpose. John reached into the pocket of his banyan and gave Hal his.
It doesn't look like a shaving cut. Were you fencing without a mask?
This was intended to be a joke. Hal had never even tried one of the new wire masks, as he seldom used a sword these days, unless he meant to kill someone with it, and thought it would be rank cowardice to fight a duel hiding behind a mask.
No. Oh, I recall. I was just turning into the street when a young lad shot out of the alley, and two soldiers just behind him shouting, "Stop thief!" One of them knocked into me and I hit the corner of that church. Didn't realize I'd hurt myself.
He pressed the handkerchief to his face. The scrape must have been painful, but he believed Hal hadn't felt it. Hal was Hal, which meant that he was either oblivious to physical circumstance in times of stress, or pretended to be, to much the same effect. And he was most assuredly under stress these days. John took the handkerchief back, dipped it into the cup of wine he'd been sipping, and pressed it to the wound again. Hal grimaced slightly, but took hold of the cloth himself.
"Wine?"
he asked.
"Claire Fraser," John replied with a shrug.
His ex-wife's notions of medicine occasionally made sense, and even army surgeons would wash a wound with wine now and then.
"Ah."
Hal had experienced Claire Fraser's medical attentions at close range and merely nodded, pressing the stained handkerchief to his cheek.
"Why ought I to be dressed?" John asked, glancing sidelong at his unfinished letter.
He was debating whether to tell Hal what he intended. His brother had an